Welcome to Cascade Church Podcast,
a church we hope is both safe to be and safe to grow.
Enjoy!
Hey, good morning to you all. My name is Kurt, and I'm a co-pastor here. I like using y'all, not because I'm from the South, but it's just the best way to refer to all y'all. So some people are like, oh, you spent some time in the South? Never. West Coast for life. But you need to throw a good y'all in there. It's nice to feel a little folksy from time to time. You know what I mean? Just a little taste of folksy. You need it. All right. This morning, speaking of folksy, I want to talk about sometimes messages we receive from our families of origin that we grow up in, like the good kind, not the bad kind. I have two sons, two boys, and when our boys were very young, and we were trying to figure out, will we ever sleep again? Like, are we going to have an uninterrupted night of sleep ever again? And there would be these moments where, like, the beginning of the child's life, they're like, yeah, I've been sleeping all day, partying all night. Why would I stop now? And you're like, you have to. And then, like, a couple months in, you get, like, a 4 or 5 hour chunk. And as a parent, this is the hubris of a young parent. You're like, did it. I think we fixed our kid. They're going to sleep through the night forever now. It was a tough couple of months, but we powered through it and we're good. And I remember sharing this with a veteran parent, you know, bedraggled, grizzled. They had seen some stuff. And they're like, I'm so happy for you. Also, here's a little bit of wisdom. Nothing lasts forever in parenting. Remember that on your best days. And remember that on your worst days, when you're like, they're never going to sleep for more than 35 minutes in a stretch, nothing lasts forever. When they sleep through the whole night and you're like, that's it, we have it fixed, nothing lasts forever. And it's been a helpful bit of wisdom to hold on to. And I've reflected over the course of my life, like some of the other bits of wisdom that like keep coming back to me. One, my dad said once to me when I was dating, he was like, remember, if you're thinking about heading towards marriage, you don't marry a person, you marry a family. And that was some real good advice. And I was like, oh, wow, I'm glad I married into this family. Because some people got some real Romeo and Juliet stuff going, and they're like, well, run away, and there's no attachment ever. And like, well, good luck with that. Those things come back. You know that nothing lasts forever thing? Yeah, that family's coming back into your life somehow, some way. Pay attention to that thing. The other thing that my dad told me that I love is you want access, not ownership. You want a friend with a boat. You know what I mean? If some of you are like, I'd like a boat, let me encourage you, no. Don't go to a boat store. Go hang out at some docks and see if you can strike up a friendship, a conversation with someone who lives there. If you're like, we need a swimming pool. No. You need a friend who has a pool and really derives joy and fulfillment out of maintaining that pool at a proper pH and balance. The reason why I bring this up is we're going to talk about wisdom and all the different ways that it comes up. But I'm interested for you, is there a bit of wisdom that you grew up with, you picked up along the way, that actually, like, it would be helpful if you were reminded of that wisdom on a weekly basis. Like I talked about raising young kids, that idea that nothing lasts forever. It was good when I was a young parent. It's actually still good today. When my kids are grown and hopefully, like, move on and are long gone and, like, they'll just ignore my calls and be like, why are you calling me? Text Dad. When that happens, nothing lasts forever will still be a helpful bit of wisdom that I'll want to be reminded of, to keep revisiting and keep coming back to. And so this question that we wanted to start with this morning, how we do things here is we want to have an opportunity not just for like the facing forward aspect of church, which is fine and good, but also the turning around and acknowledging, hey, I'm here with a lot of other amazing human beings who have their own wisdom and their own stories. So we want to create a space for you to share and talk with people. If you're like, oh, no, don't worry. You don't have to say anything. This can be the listening portion of the time for you. But what we do is we just encourage you to turn around, kind of loose groups around there. Just make sure no one's left out. And if you can just say your name, and if you have one, what's a piece of wisdom you wish you could be reminded of on a weekly basis? So if you could turn it. All right. If we're able to gather back together as a whole, come back up. I have to say, I hope you understand what I mean in saying this. Interrupting you all is one of my favorite things to do because it means you're still talking and you have these great conversations. Because when I'm like, hey, turn and talk to the people around you, and there's that beat of silence, I'm like, this is the week. No one talks. And then we always have to interrupt. And I really enjoy that. All right. I hope that you'd be able to continue those conversations with the folks around you and think more this morning as we're going to kind of reflect on what's the role of wisdom in our lives. How do we interact with wisdom? How do you discern what's like kind of actual wisdom and what's just like kind of timely advice for a moment? When I talked about those things, the reason why those pieces of advice, like I would call in my own life wisdom, is because they've kept returning to me. I've been told lots of wisdom that's just never come back. It's just never returned back to me in my life. And so I think that kind of demonstrates, like that might have been some timely advice. It might have been a helpful insight for a moment, but I don't know if that's wisdom. Wisdom kind of demonstrates itself over time. And so as we reflect on that this morning, we're going to look at a story of Jesus, from the life of Jesus. And what we're specifically looking at this morning is that there's lots of stories of Jesus. That's like kind of how we know about him, the stories. There's a way of reading and like a surface level way of interpreting the stories of Jesus. Like he says this, they say this. But sometimes we don't have all the context of what are the social dynamics underlying them. Who in the story has influence and choices and who doesn't in the story? And when we uncover it, I think there's a way of taking the wisdom of Jesus and more appropriately applying it to the life, our life and the world around us. Because sometimes what can happen is we take this insight and experience of Jesus and we go to apply it, and in fact, we apply it not to those who do not have power and are not served, but we apply it to the powerful. So when a person who was the president of the United States says, my favorite verse in the Bible is an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, you go, huh. That's an interesting application of something that was wisdom in the Bible. Also, did you go to the New Testament? Because Jesus actually covered that again. And he actually said this whole, like, you've heard it said, but I say to you thing. A kind of don't do that. The thing that was progressive and helpful at the time, hey, when something takes something from you, have something that's a reciprocal return to make sure that there can be equality, forgiveness, and reconciliation to move forward. That might have been a huge step forward in all humanity, a step towards a better picture of how God wants us to interact. When people would harm you and you're like, well, I'm going to hit you back 10 times so you learn the lesson to never harm me, an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth was an incredible step forward. And this is what I love about faith and Christ and how God is calling us forward. God's not saying you need to look to the past and keep yourself limited to past experiences, but saying, I have more for you. We're going ahead, and something that can be timely and helpful now, we actually need to modify it so we get closer to the way that we are called to live and engage in a world where God created everyone. And if everyone's has value, maybe eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth was good, but turn the other cheek is better. And that's leading us further, a deeper kind of wisdom. So if you have a Bible app on your phone, if you brought a Bible with you, all of that, I encourage you to pull it out and look at it. If you don't, it's going to be on the screen. But like this week is a perfect example. I'm going to be covering, we're looking at Luke 7. I'm going to be starting in verse 20. I'm going to go to 26, and then I'm going to skip ahead to 33 and 35. And if some of you are like, what is this pastor hiding? Read away. It's right there for you to look at. I encourage you to get the greater context. For time and what we're focusing on in the story this morning, I'm not covering that. But you should, when you get bored with what I'm saying, check out the Bible. It's a good way to fact check whoever is up here. So, as we read a bit of context, We're Luke 7. Luke is one of the four stories, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, about the life of Jesus. Some of the stories have overlap. Some are unique in the way they talk about it. Each of the four gospels, just good news of Jesus, is a different focus, a different way of looking at who Jesus is with different emphases. And so this week, we're going to be looking at Luke. Within the story of Jesus, we hear about John the Baptist. And in Luke 1, it talks about Zechariah and Elizabeth. These are the parents of John the Baptist, that he is born a little bit before Jesus. We actually have this fun story about a leaping of joy within the belly of Elizabeth from John the Baptist, because recognizes that Mary is pregnant here. This kind of allusion to a tie to that John the Baptist and Jesus are connected. And what we see in the story is John the Baptist goes out into the wilderness, and he's calling people out into the wilderness. He's wearing camel hair. He's kind of a wild man. And it's this prophetic call. Now, we call him John the Baptist. Baptism wasn't really the practice of the Jewish people now. It's a Christian practice that we do now. But this would have been a kind of ritualistic cleansing with which you would put the entirety of your body in water as a kind of preparation for the coming of God. So John the Baptist, and we still do and observe baptism today, but we reinterpret it in light of who Jesus is within the Christian community. He was calling them, come prepare yourself, come and do it, engage in this ritualistic cleansing, this embodied recognition that God's coming, God's presence is here, and I want to be prepared and aware, awake and alert. Where is God showing up in the world today? Okay? Now, John the Baptist has been imprisoned because, and this is where when people are like, I just want the Bible, I don't really want politics, I'm like, I got bad news for you about the Bible. The Bible is political. The Bible kind of concludes with Jesus being killed as an enemy of the state, a political killing. Because ultimately what Jesus was doing and what John the Baptist was doing is by calling people out and saying there's another system with which you can operate, it was undercutting the Jewish religious system of its time and the Roman Empire system of its time. That these are ultimately not the ultimate authorities of how we live and orient our lives. There's a different way of orienting our lives that trumps these. It's more important than these. And so John is imprisoned because of this. Not because he's like, you guys should be friendlier. You should be like kinder to your neighbors. And they're like, ooh, we don't like that because we're bad guys. Isn't it a Marvel movie? It's a complex reality, same as a complex reality we live in today, that is political, that is involved with power dynamics and how things operate. So let's kind of understand that there's some followers of John the Baptist who are being sent to Jesus, and that's what sets the scene for us. In Luke 7, starting in verse 20, it says, John the Baptist has sent you to ask, are you the one who is to come, or we'd expect someone else? Jesus had just then cured many people of diseases, afflictions, and evil spirits, and had given sight to many who were blind. And he answered them, go and tell John what you have seen and heard. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, those with a skin disease are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, the poor have good news brought to them, and blessed is anyone who takes no offense at me. Continuing on in verse 24, it says, when John's messengers had gone, Jesus began to speak to the crowds about John. What did you go out into the wilderness to look at? A reed shaken by the wind? What then did you go out to see? Someone dressed in soft robes? Look, those who put on fine clothing and live in luxury are in royal palaces. What then did you go out to see? A prophet? Yes, I tell you, and more than a prophet. So let's pause there for a second to kind of unpack some of what's happening. The first part is that we see Jesus involved in healing ministries, and I talked about it a little bit more in depth last week, but just to hit back on it, the important underlying thing to look at with the social dynamics, the people that Jesus are healing, it's not just people that have a problem. It's people for whom their issues that they're facing at the time mean that they are excluded from the community. And specifically, the Jewish religious system of the day, as kind of all religious systems can tend to move or gravitate towards, end up having some kind of restrictions from people that should belong. And they say, actually, you can't really be here if you're this, or if this is something that you're afflicted with, or this is something. And so you had people that did not have access because they were blind, they were lame, they had skin disease. Lepers had a community that was outside of the city, so they couldn't participate in the community that exists. I still contend that what Jesus is doing intentionally is going out to those people to bring them into community, not saying these people are deeply flawed and they need to be fixed so that they can belong. No, you all will not accept these individuals as they are. So if miraculous healing is what's necessary for you to understand that they belong to, then that's what's going to happen. But look at who Jesus is including and going out and healing. Now, taking a step back to John the Baptist, I love, 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 love the humanity and the richness of humanity of this. Have you ever been a part of something you deeply believe in? You are convicted. This is the right thing to do. And then you get into it and you face some adversity and you're like, uh-oh, was this the right thing to do? Because there's a lot of data points right now that says maybe this wasn't the right thing to be doing. John the Baptist gave himself to saying, God is going to show up in a way that is going to remind us of who God is going to recall the people of Israel back into their identity as God's people so that the blessings of God will come into all the world. And it's amazing to look at how the ministry of Jesus accomplishes this. And one of the first steps we see is the eradication of God's people and not God's people. The first thing the earliest disciples do is they say, Jew and Gentile, you all belong. Good news accessible to all people. This is what he believes had happened. But now he's imprisoned and he's like, was I right? Did I give my life to a lie? Did I dedicate all this time and effort and energy to something that's kind of phony and kind of fake? A devastating emotion. I love that he's like, go ask, go show up and see. Now, what Jesus is saying here, I love that Jesus doesn't say, well, of course it is me. Let's go back to my baptism. So when I came out, a dove descended and it's like, this is my son with whom I love. Proof point number one. Two, temptation. Satan came and visited me. Kind of a big deal. He doesn't visit everybody. I dealt with all those temptations. Proof point number two. Jesus doesn't go through his CV and resume. He doesn't go through and just say, check it out. Of course it's me. Jesus says, look around what's happening now. You want to know about the kingdom of God? Is the kingdom of God present here? Look around the room. Are people that were previously excluded now included? There's the proof of the presence of God. Here's some of what, before we go on to the last part, I get so excited and passionate about. If you grew up in like Protestant churches, or if you grew up in Catholic communities, Orthodox, any of them, if you're aware of Protestant denominations, you know there are so many, so many. You can't just be like, I'm Christian. And if you grew up with someone else who's Christian, if you grew up with someone who wasn't Christian, they'll be like, cool, that's great. If you grew up with something that wasn't Christian, they're like, what kind? Like Lutheran, Presbyterian, Wesleyan, Methodist, Catholic, Latter-day Saints, Jehovah's Witnesses, Seventh-day Adventist. Like, what flavor of Jesus are you? Because we've done a bajillion of those. And what I think is interesting about each and every single one of them, every single one of them came about via a revolution. The way that we are talking about who Jesus is and how Jesus shows up is not working for everyone, and so we necessarily need a new iteration of this happening. And so they bring about something new and different than had previously existed in our understanding of who Christ is and how the world works. And then, after they've existed for a little bit of time, and then people start coming, and people start giving money, and maybe they buy some land and build a building, they're like, I mean, the revolution was nice, but let's not let go of the buildings. I mean, if we lost all the money that we've done, that would actually be like a kind of bad idea. And we start trading revolution for stability. And the thing that we start preaching and moving forward, if we're really honest, isn't Jesus so much as protection of the entity. At a certain point, and I'm not trying to pick on anyone, Lutheranism becomes more important than Jesus. Methodism becomes more important than Jesus. Catholicism becomes more important than Jesus. And why? Because there's ability to be known, to be safe, and to be secured within an organization of power that has community relations and all kinds of beautiful things, but we kind of lose the plot. And it's not just religious people. The United States of America, we started as a revolution, and now look at us. We are a power protection machine. And if you don't believe me, go check out our defense budget. We're not so much interested in being a revolutionary country built on ideals and scrap. No, we're desperately trying to protect all of our interests, and we're kind of trying to expand our interests where we can. Like some of the things, even more recently, I still laugh, and you may or may not, Alaska and Hawaii. When I was growing up, and like, these are the United States of America. And we put these two on the bottom because they're really far away, but we liked them, so we took them. Because we want to expand. Have you ever flown to Hawaii? That's not a quick flight. And when you show up, you're like, huh, this is the United States of America? Or is this just like a really convenient military base on the way to another part of the world? Here's why I bring all this up. If you're uncomfortable, I apologize. Good. Should be uncomfortable to look in the United States of America mirror, as it's uncomfortable to look in any mirror where we start with ideals and wisdom and idea of involving and including others, but we lose the plot and we start trying to protect what we already have. What Jesus is saying is, how do you know that I'm the one that God sent? Is because this is not about protection, this is about inclusion. It's so embodied in Jesus. If Jesus is the Son of God who has all power to heal, what is Jesus doing with that power? I'm going to say it every single week. What is Jesus doing with that power? He's giving it away to those that don't have it. Jesus never invests in his own defense budget. Jesus never is like, hey, come and look at me and how powerful I am. If, like, the most cynical view of Jesus, if he's doing magic tricks, he never does things where, like, I'm going to levitate for a little bit. Check that out. He's always utilizing this power on behalf of those that do not have it. That should tell us a lot about what it means to seek after a different way of showing up and living in the world. Let's jump ahead to verse 33 to 35. Jesus says to the crowd, "For John the Baptist has come eating no bread and drinking no wine, and you say, he has a demon. The Son of Man, speaking of himself, has come eating and drinking. You say, look at a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Nevertheless, wisdom is vindicated by all her children." Every once in a while, I read through the Bible, and there's just a real haunting line. Wisdom is vindicated by all her children has been my haunting line as I've been preparing for this message. Just keeps on coming. Wisdom is vindicated by all her children. What I love about this is Jesus says, you all went out to see John the Baptist, who was rejecting the culture and the world that we live in. He was calling us to something else outside of it. He wasn't doing any of the partying. And you were like, yeah, that proves that he's not the one. Jesus is like, I've been in the center of it. Partying, hanging out, going to meals with people. I've been hanging out with tax collectors who you don't like. When Jesus says sinners, let's just talk about this for a second. Jesus says sinners a lot. He hangs out with sinners. If you think about that for a second, within the context of within a religious system, who are the sinners? Everybody. Everybody's a sinner. You may not be now, but you have been, and you probably will be. We all fall short of whatever the system or understanding is that the rules that you have to do. When Jesus says sinners, he's saying the people that have fallen outside of the religious rules of the day and cannot or have not gone through the ritualistic things to be reinstated into the community. When Jesus says sinners, he's talking about people that you will not allow back in, not people who have made mistakes. And because Jesus is hanging out with them, for some, that diminishes or drops to zero his credibility. So Jesus is saying, what is it? If you don't do any of this stuff, you're like, yeah, not it. If you do all of this stuff, you're like, not it. It might be something else that we need to be looking for. There might be something else that we see and acknowledge in one another that we're calling into being, a kind of wisdom. All right, I want to tell you a quick story. When I graduated high school, I went to junior college in the Central Valley of California for a couple years. I got my AA degree, going to school alongside many 25 to 30-year-olds as like an 18-year-old. Like, if any of you went to junior college, it's a wild ride. I don't even think we call them junior colleges anymore. They're community colleges now. We cleaned it up. I went there for 2 years. I got my AA, and then I was looking to transfer, and I went up to Seattle Pacific, a Christian school, because I wanted to go there because they had a program in youth ministry, and I knew I wanted to go into that. To apply to a school, you need letters of recommendation. So I went back to my high school to see my favorite teacher. He was my humanities teacher, English teacher, had a huge impact on my life, had challenged me and got me thinking in new ways about how the world works and all that. I loved being around him. And so I showed back up at high school to get the letter of recommendation from him, you know, because we didn't have like email. That's how old I am. Let's just name it. So I show back up to see Mr. Fashner. And I go to his class, and he's like, hey, this is so exciting. Like, glad to write. Like, where are you looking at going to school? And I'm like, South Pacific. He's like, why that school? I'm like, because I want to get into ministry. I want to, like, work in churches. And he said, don't do that. And I was like, oh, I didn't really see this coming. I kind of thought this would be a little bump on the road to getting there, not a huge smackdown, like whack-a-mole of my dreams. So what he said was, he's like, I did that too. I got into teaching because I wanted to make a difference and inspire and all that. And now that I'm at the stage where I'm at, I look around and I'm like, it's not worth it. I put in just as much work as all these other people, and yet I don't have the same kind of financial stability. I don't have the same security as everyone else I know. It's not worth it. And you know what I heard? I was like, I mean, I don't want to be presumptuous. I kind of thought, like, your impact on me was some of the proof that you did the right thing. My passion to go do teaching, to go be involved in the same thing, I actually thought was, like, it's part of your legacy. I kind of thought it mattered. And I don't fault Mr. Fashner. I think, ultimately, what that story is proof to me is that he lived, and we live in a world that subtly and not so subtly says, this is the way success is measured. And ultimately, if you live in that system long enough that says independence and financial well-being and strength and proper investments and home ownership and all of these things are the way to be successful, and you don't have those at a certain point, it's tough not to believe that I failed and actually missed out on it too. What I think was missing is that there is a wisdom about the way that we impact one another that is way more important than the amount of money we have in our bank accounts at the end. And I've been fortunate enough in my life to talk to enough people with a lot of money in their bank accounts to know what? They're not saying it's awesome either. In fact, those folks are like, keep doing what you're doing because it feels like it actually matters. Because they got to the end of all the things that he wanted, and they still didn't have it. The reason why I bring this story up, and we tie it to Jesus and John the Baptist, I think John the Baptist and Mr. Fashner were having a similar moment where they'd given their life to something they were sure was true, and they were at a moment they're like, I don't think this actually worked out. And my question for all of us is, where do we go and remind ourselves of real wisdom? Where do we go and fight against the message of the culture that we live in to say that success is always defined as independence? Success is always defined at having what you want when you want. And I think in the presence of Jesus and Jesus communities is exactly that place. Wisdom is vindicated by her children. Another way of saying that is look at the legacy of wisdom. What does wisdom put out into the world time and time again? And wisdom can look like John the Baptist, and wisdom can look like Jesus. But ultimately, what's the impact of this way of showing up and being in the world? There is a kind of wisdom that we peddle and we talk about that only work for some and might even work for you. But true wisdom, what Jesus was saying, it was look around and see how this wisdom is present, is a wisdom works for everyone. Someone doesn't have to suffer for this version of wisdom to be true. That everyone can benefit from this kind of wisdom. My hope is that church, regardless of your relationship to prayer or church or God or any of that, at a fundamental level, it can be a place where we come and fight and resist the grand delusion that there's some kind of success that exists outside that isn't about the thriving of all people. And we face it and we acknowledge it and we resist against it with peace and with grace and with radical inclusion. A kind of love and recognizing who's excluded and how do we make sure they're included. That can be a place of thriving, where we fight against the idea that every revolution becomes an institution. And we fight against as much institutionalism as possible, not because we're super punk rock and down with a man, but because of the deeper truth that we don't want to become so power-centric and protective that people get hurt and harmed in the process. I hope and pray that this can be a place of church for all of us. Would you pray with me?